You want to give us a count in?
Sure. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and welcome to Sons of the Double Cheeseburger. I am your co-host, Kevin, with Brandon.
Yes, and that voice that you heard is Kevin.
Yes.
Oh, wait, you already said that.
I said that.
Did
we lose you?
Yeah, I got a little confused. I got a little...
Count in from five too long?
No, it was... I was just feeling daydreamy this morning, so... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, coming to you from the Third Coast and the Left Coast.
Uh-huh, that's right.
It is Sons of the Double Cheeseburger. How are you doing, Brandon?
I'm good. I am pretty good. This is week two of Zachary being back in school. He's only in school for 3 hours a day for 4 days. So it's like he's back in school, but it's, you know, there's about a 2.5 hour window 4 times a week, which and again, I want to be very clear. My son is 18 and he's an adult man. But it is a little bit like when your kids are in preschool and you're like, oh, I've got a break. And they're like, oh, my God, it's time to go pick them up already.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a little like that.
I loved it when we had things like our church would say, drop your kids off for an hour. The youth group will watch them. And you can have an hour to do errands or go out to dinner or do whatever you need to do.
Oh, my gosh.
And we were like, what? No.
An hour? What? I know.
And it was a parking lot full of parents just sitting in their cars.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't. That's a good time to nap, in my opinion.
Right. So then we gave the youth group $20 per kid to watch our kids for an hour while we sat in the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, that fits my model of fundraising that is more painful than it should be.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. So, yeah, so I got that going on. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I don't know that there's nothing. There's nothing, I mean, you know, in terms of me personally, there's really nothing.
All right. Fair enough.
You know, doing this baseball thing, and we got a game tomorrow, and there's about 30 things that need to be done that have nothing to do with actually leading practice or.
So what I think you're experiencing at this point is not merely being the manager of the team, but thinking back to like a guy like Rube Foster, mm-hmm. right, of the Chicago American Giants, who was the manager and the general manager and the owner and the promoter and the, like, he was doing everything. You're wearing the hats, aren't you?
Well, yes and no. So I'm not going to play down the hard work that Rube Foster put in.
Yes,
it'd be poor form.
I mean, he also formed a league, so I want to be clear about that. Yeah.
Right. There are supposed to be people at the league level who are taking care of certain things.
Okay.
And they're not getting taken care of. And then I'm supposed to be able to go to these people for answers to certain things, and I can't get answers. Things aren't getting taken care of, so I'm just kind of left. It's more just trying to juggle things that I can't resolve because I can't get the support I'm supposed to.
Sure.
Which still ends up being a time suck.
Yeah.
And it's just frustrating. At least Rube Foster got to make the decisions, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At the end of the day, he had the satisfaction of, I accomplished this.
That's correct.
Assuming that's how Rube Foster felt, right? You see pictures of him. He seemed like a guy who was satisfied with his day's work, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and proud of what he'd accomplished. Right. Rightfully so, now. Yeah.
You look at me at the end of the day, and I just look like, I'm standing in a bucket.
So do any of those people listen to our podcast?
I don't know.
Okay, folks, if you do, get your shit together. Come on. Mm-hmm. Give this man some support.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? Actually, I thought about it. You reminded me. No. Anything more about baseball?
No. No. Okay. Other than our pitching is a bit spotty right now.
Oh, man. You and every other major league team.
We are.
It's actually not. Do you realize? This is just a brief aside. There are, as of this recording, there are 7 pitchers who have pitched enough innings to qualify for the ERA title, mm-hmm. who have ERAs under 2.
Well, right. I mean, it's clear that we are in another one of those eras where pitching is has such an advantage over hitting.
And there's another pitcher who doesn't have enough innings to qualify, but is close. And has an ERA under 0.75.
Is that Craig Kimbrel?
No, that's Corbin Burnes.
Oh, right, yeah.
Corbin Burnes and Jacob DeGrom are both significantly below 1 a quarter of the way into the season.
It's that thing where, I mean, there comes a point where what pitchers are able to do exceeds what batters can effectively keep up with.
Yeah.
And so... And then when pitchers can both do that and not have to worry about, like, pitchers don't have to worry about fielding their position. So then the pitchers have all the advantage of, you know, a massive data dump that allows their fielders to know fairly precisely where to go with each type of pitch they're going to throw to a particular batter,
mm-hmm.
where the ball is going to be hit. A pitcher can just sell out.
Yeah.
You know? Now, here's something that annoys me. So, you know, on the Cubs broadcast last night, they were talking about this, the TV broadcast, and how, you know, it used to be that a 2-to-1 strikeout-to-walk ratio was considered a really effective pitcher.
Right.
And, you know, they're pointing out that now there's pitchers who have, like, 10-to-1, 15-to-1 ratios.
Yeah.
What annoyed me is that Boog,
who
I'm still prepared to say this is not working.
It's not working for you. Yeah. Okay.
He said that this is because pitchers walk guys so much fewer now than they so much less often than they used to. And I said you have looked at the data and taken away the wrong.
That is an alarming bit of poor analysis.
Because you look at that, a league leader in strikeouts, when there wasn't Nolan Ryan, for instance, might lead the league with like 6 or 7 strikeouts a game.
Yeah.
Pitchers pitch to contact, and that was because pitchers pitch 7, 8, or 9 innings a game. Now pitchers pitch to strikeouts because pitchers pitch 4, 5, sometimes 6 innings a game.
Yes.
Pitchers don't have higher strikeout rates or higher strikeout to walk ratios now because they have better control. It's because they can sell out for strikeouts to a degree that no pitcher 30 or 40 years ago would have ever considered.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean and that's an institutional decision to say go for max effort and we will use you as long as you can give us max effort and then we'll move on to the next guy, which used to be the thing that you would say, like there was as relief pitching was expanding, you would hear them say that a relief pitcher is a guy who doesn't have 3 or 4 good pitches. He has maybe 1 or 2. And so you tell that guy, give max effort on those 1 or 2 and we'll take what we get from you.
But even that was often like 2 innings.
Yeah. A lot of times.
I'd be curious to look at box scores from 70s or 80s and see, or we don't have to look at box scores. What was the average number of pitchers a team used per game? I'm guessing up until, I'm not going to say fairly recently, but up until within our lifetimes, it was less than 2.
Yeah, I think that's fair. By the way,
it was less than 2 is pretty aggressive. It was probably less than 2.5. I'm going to say that.
So Boog's suggestion was that batters are walking less.
Yeah, but that, right. Also, we also know batters are walking far more.
I was going to say the walk rate so far this season is 9.2% of all plate appearances. And just 5 years ago, it was 8.3% of all plate appearances. So that's demonstrably wrong. Sorry, Boog. If you want to come on the podcast and apologize to our massive listening audience, you can.
I mean, you had a game in the past where batters put a premium on putting the ball in play, and pitchers put a premium on getting pitches in a spot where batters would put it in play.
Yeah. That's true. No, it's. Yeah. I mean, there have been real shifts in the game, and that's why, you know, there. I think that they really do have to think about changes both on the pitcher side and on the batter side to sort of force balance back. Mm-hmm. And I want us to come back to that a little bit more. We were gonna talk about
sidetracked here, didn't we?
No, it's okay. It's where we're headed today. So if you're sitting there listening and going, oh my God, they're talking about baseball, you're gonna check out early probably. So you might want to skip to the end for the overview.
We are going to abuse ourselves somewhere around the middle, right?
We are. Well, I was thinking it's about time I wanted to mention that. Although I want to start to lead into that point with this. I believe that I told you this. I don't know if I've told the podcast audiences that I became aware 2 months ago of the existence of a Twitter feed that tracks when people are the same age as Wilfred Brimley was when the movie Cocoon came out.
Okay.
Did we talk about this?
You know, I know we've talked about Wilfred Brimley. So I didn't recall that was the context.
So, yeah, so there is a website that or a Twitter feed that actually will track and say so-and-so is now exactly the same age as Wilfred Brimley was to the day when the movie Cocoon premiered or debuted in theaters. And they'll show you a picture of that person next to Wilfred Brimley. And that person, of course, always looks like they're at least a generation younger than Wilfred Brimley.
Right.
I've told this story to some of the young people in my life. And by young people, I now mean people in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And they generally have no idea who Wilfred Brimley is or what Cocoon is. And then they look it up and they're like, oh my gosh, that dude is so old.
What was he, like 22 at the time?
He was. So this is the thing. This is what caught my attention.
He passed recently, right?
He did pass recently. We talked about him last year for a while, remember?
And I accidentally
defaced his Facebook page. Yeah, right.
That's cool.
So good times. Anyway, Wilfred Brimley was 51, no, 50 and change.
So
I figured it out that my Wilfred Brimley Cocoon Day is June 19th. So this year, Juneteenth is also the day that I am the same age Wilfred Brimley was in Cocoon. And so
I don't know if that dishonors Juneteenth or not.
But I don't think they're gonna probably, like, attach it. I don't think they're gonna like really do it at, like, let's do a 2-for-1. I just said they, and I want to be was a really big mistake on my part. What I mean is people worldwide who pay attention to Juneteenth, all people who pay attention to Juneteenth are not going to say, oh yeah, let's also give some love to Brandon's Brimley Cocoon Day. I understand that. But I thought to myself, you know, because what Wilfred Brimley is most noted for, besides looking ancient, is having a giant push broom mustache.
Yes.
So I thought, you know what? Let's start now and let's see how close I can get to a Wilfred Brimley mustache.
And how you think you're doing?
Well, I am now at the point where my mustache curls into my lip, like just now I could do that. I pursed my lips together. And I caught some mustache in there.
Yeah, that's gross. I think what you're going for is for it to be long enough where you can trim it and then it's straight coming down.
Yeah.
Past that point. And that's going to be long. That's going to be longer than I think you anticipate.
Oh, it's going to, no, I anticipate that it's got to be quite long.
What you need to be doing right now is combing it to the, parting it at your, what do they call that little spot under your nose?
That is the, I don't know, the meridian? I don't know.
Sanctum sanctorum, or no, it's like a... I know it's not that, people. All right, I know what that means. No, it's, there's a name for it.
The feel philtrum.
Like oh, there you go. So, you need to then comb it to the sides. So,
or it's also called the infranasal depression.
I think philtrum's better.
Have you ever suffered from infranasal depression, Kevin?
I've done them all. I've done tropical depression. I've done subtropical depression. Anyway, so that's what you're going to want to do is...
Well, I've been doing some combing. Yeah.
Good, 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 good.
Yeah.
And what we should also point out is that Wilford Brimley's is not a true push broom. Like, a true push broom is kind of like John Bolton.
Yeah.
The warmonger.
Yeah, I won't be working on... There is no John Bolton day.
Because Wilford Brimley does kind of the push broom length and fullness, but he takes it down past the corners of the mouth.
Yes.
In a way. So he kind of blends two different types. Yeah. It's a good mustache. It really is. I don't think most people could pull off a mustache like that, either in terms of growing it or just if it's on their face, it looking like it should be there. Right. So,
yeah. Right. So I'm working on that. June 19th is the big target day. My wife at this point will only barely let me give her a peck on the cheek.
Well,
she's like,
is that all related to this or is that?
That's the excuse she's using now.
Well, she's savvy.
She is. She's a quick one. I did actually start. So in addition to that, I realized I wanted to grow like the Fu Manchu. So I started late on that, but nobody can tell because I'm always wearing a mask. So I'm now trying to get the Fu Manchu part to catch up to the rest of it.
All right. You know what? You also, this is, I'm sorry, I'm going to take an aside.
Yeah.
So after we had that experience of seeing Sam Elliott without a mustache, right?
Yes. Yes.
You need to explore. Suddenly that opens the door. There's all sorts of people that you wonder, what do they look like? Sans stash, right? With an open upper lip. Well, Wilford Brimley with an open upper lip is not the same person.
Oh my God.
Did you look this up then?
I just did, yes. Yeah. What's hilarious is, okay, so I searched for...
He just looks sad.
I searched for Wilford Brimley without mustache. And the first picture is, I'm pretty sure, Wilford Brimley without a mustache. And yes, he looks sad. He looks a little bit like the English actor Toby Jones. Okay. Then I have a man in a cowboy hat. Who, like a young man in a cowboy hat that maybe is a young Wilford Brimley, although I don't know. And then I have Sam Elliott in a scene from The Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah.
I don't understand why. I said Wilford Brimley without a mustache. Sam Elliott in Big Lebowski is as far as you can get from Wilford Brimley without a mustache. That's the antonym of Wilford Brimley without mustache.
See, then I found an article. Yeah, you're exactly right. I found an article that's called Can You Recognize These Actors Without Their Iconic Mustaches?
Okay.
And some of these, it's so easy. I mean, like Tom Selleck, please, come on. He's sure he's got a bushy mustache, but you can tell Tom Selleck.
I had somebody tell me that mine looks like Tom Selleck.
Oh, well, that's not so bad.
No?
Did they tell you look like Tom Selleck? Because that would be better.
Is he still alive?
He is. He did that Blue Bloods propaganda show on...
Oh, that's right.
ABC or CBS, whichever one of those.
CBS.
Yeah.
If it's aimed at old people, assume CBS.
Like Burt Reynolds without a mustache? You know, you can tell.
Yeah.
Young Burt Reynolds without a mustache looks like Marlon Brando. Young Marlon Brando.
Yeah, he does. I'm looking at this now. I went to this.
Sherman Hemsley without a mustache. I thought that was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and I'm sorry to say that.
He doesn't look like Sherman Hemsley.
And then Sam Elliott without a mustache is easy to tell because he still has two other mustaches. They're just above his eyes, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Sam Elliott grows mustaches so well that
he just grows them all over his body.
Yeah, his eyebrow mustaches are better than most people's. Lip mustaches.
Do you wonder, like, do those, because I'm looking at that picture and it's clearly two eyebrow mustaches. It's not a unibrow, but the man grows hair so
his head of hair right there is shocking.
It's gigantic mane. Yeah, it's amazing. So you really wonder, like, did his eyebrows naturally stay separated, or did he have to do a Herculean amount of pruning?
All right, so this picture, you folks can't see it because it's on the internet, which is where you find us too, but it's not in the same place.
Not in the same place, no.
But it's Sam
although
Elliot
we could put this picture where you find us.
It's Sam Elliott with his we could with his shirt off.
His chest hair is invading north, isn't it? That's amazing.
Right. So what I'm wondering is, I look at this picture of Sam Elliott. I see how much hair he has at the top.
Uh-huh.
It's a big wig. It's not. It's not a wig, but it's gigantic.
Yeah,
you could.
It's a powerful dome.
You could. You could cure many bald men with that amount of hair.
You could. And then I think you could also have struck him with a cast iron skillet and not injured him.
It might be a horn by that point, right? I'm wondering. Then I see no hair on his shoulders. No. And as a man with a hairy chest,
yeah,
I know that the older you get, it doesn't stop. It goes, right? It's. I'm feeling like there has been, as an actor, the stories are famous where, you know, there's been body modification. Now this is just shaving. Mm-hmm. But I have a feeling that he, you know, that there's somebody on set who is, you know, when doing his makeup, they're also cleaning up the unibrow. And, you know, removing the hair from his shoulders.
So you're saying manscaping was going on?
He's been heavily manscaped. I would be my guess. I would never ask him that question because that seems rude. But if I had to guess, and I mean, no.
Well, Kevin, I'm not going to try.
Now, see, he does Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois commercials.
Yeah.
You're going to need some Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance after I'm done with you.
That's right.
For suggesting that I've been manscaped.
Well, and maybe
that was a pretty good Sam Elliott, I think.
That was a pretty good one. That was pretty good.
Oh, my gosh. Did I find a Sam Elliott? Well, I mean, it's not good. It's not good.
It's better than my Paul McCartney that sounds like Sean Connery. So I think you could be right, but then the question that begs the question: Why would you groom his shoulders?
Well, because he has his shirt off clearly, and some people say, ooh,
so chest hair looks cool,
sexy chest hair. Nobody says sexy shoulder hair, right? Have you ever heard that?
I have not, to be honest.
No. It's just so. I mean, he may
you know
be,
Zachary's growing hair on his back. In a pattern that looks like they're like proto wings. That's awesome. That's a hairy kid right there.
Well, yeah, I mean,
Hal Linden looks like Peter Lorre.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know who this guy is with or without a mustache, so that doesn't help.
This is Charlie Chaplin.
Okay. Well, showing Charlie Chaplin in advanced age doesn't help anybody.
Folks, don't you think this is Charlie Chaplin? Yes, it's clearly Charlie Chaplin. The next one is clearly John Astin.
John Astin also is also clearly...
There's no way you would not know John Astin.
That's
you could cut off half of
right
John
there.
Astin's face and still know who John Astin is. Both his eyes and his mouth are distinctive enough.
Yeah,
right?
And his nose. All of it. So. You could cut off any, like, half his face, like you said, but literally any half.
Groucho Marx, the next one, clearly.
Yeah.
The next one is... I
believe that's Denver Pyle.
Who the heck is Denver Pyle?
He was the hazard, the Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh my god, are you kidding me?
No.
Oh, all right. Now that one. I see he was a.
And then there's Wilford Brimley. Again, sad look. Seriously, look up Toby Jones, and he looks like him.
I will. Well, let's get back to podcasting where people.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose. Okay. So anyway, so Kevin, you're going to get to see the progress and maybe report to everyone the progress of my Brimley stash, because I'm coming to Chicago. So. And it may be that we get in one more recording before that, but one of these upcoming recordings we're going to do in person together when I am in town for a couple of weeks. So I'm excited. I'm really looking forward to meeting you and to seeing what you actually look like.
Right. This is gonna be great. Put a face with the voice.
Yeah. I've wondered so much. Like
I've rented the Chicago Theater for us to record.
Oh, good choice. Good call. For a live show, yeah.
They booted Wait, Don't Tell Me, and we're on stage there now.
Nice. That's excellent.
They said our capacity is limited to 40%. I said, don't worry. We'll be fine.
Yeah, we should be fine. Have tickets started selling out yet?
Probably not. Okay. I haven't checked. I didn't really book it. I'm going to be honest with you.
Man, I feel so deceived now.
Yeah, that's me.
I don't even know if you're who I really think you are. Like, yeah. I've always been like imagining, like when I think, what does this voice look like?
Well, tough tacos to you. Who cares?
I've been thinking Sherman Hemsley, but younger.
Your feelings don't matter to me. Sherman Hemsley, but younger. Okay. Well, I don't think you're going to be disappointed.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. Okay. So because we're getting ready to come for me to come to Chicago. We thought that today was a good day to introduce all of you who may not know about it to something that is called, Jepson's Malort Liqueur.
Right.
I know that we've referenced this was coming, this is in our series of tasting things, trying them out. Kevin, have you ever had Malort?
I have not.
Neither have I. So this will be first time for both of us. I believe that we have already said previously that Malort has a variety of slogans, things like give your mouth a kick in the balls.
Right, right.
It is... I believe that when we looked it up at one point, something like 85% of all Malort is consumed in Cook County, Illinois.
Okay, I would believe that. I hadn't looked it up. I'm in DuPage County, so.
And I'm also not in Cook County.
I'm in Collar County, right. So, what's they call it? Well, that's all right. You know what? We'll fall into that 15%.
Yeah, we are. So... I'm pouring myself a little Malort right now.
All right.
For those of you who don't know anything about it, it's a botanical liqueur.
Ooh.
That has its essence is wormwood. It's very pale.
And it doesn't really have much of a nose.
No, it doesn't. I mean, pale, like a little paler than most whiskey, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it looks like a healthy urine. You know, or maybe if you're slightly dehydrated.
I really? I wish you hadn't said that just before we drink it. But yeah, that's pretty accurate because it's a little yellower than like a whiskey.
Right. You've had a hard day of... you know, I don't know,
hog butchering
or skyscraper building.
Why?
Doing Chicago-y activities, right?
Yeah.
You know, digging tunnels out to the middle of a gigantic freshwater lake or reversing the flow of rivers. And you've maybe not hydrated quite as well as you should have.
Yeah.
This is it.
So the word Malort is actually, what language is that? It is actually the word for wormwood.
Oh, is it? It is. Swedish or?
Yes, Swedish. That's right, because Carl Jepsen was a Swede. Wormwood is has the ability to kill stomach worms and other parasites. The wormwood used to make Malort has an extremely low thujone level. This is important because thujone is the chemical compound that makes absinthe potentially mind-bending.
Right. Yeah, and that's open to debate whether that really is, but yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
You ready?
I am. Cheers.
Cheers.
Really been built up too much. I expected it to be. Oh, never mind.
It.
I was gonna say I expected it to be worse, but no. There it is.
It doesn't. Yeah. It's very low on like burn in the chest. Mm. You know what I mean? At least for
it
me.
All stays in your mouth. There's, it really coats the everything in the mouth.
Yeah, it does.
It does that.
It does. I mean, like a good strong whiskey or scotch, you know, goes down into your chest. This, you're right. This is all just staying up in the palate.
This is oily. This is it's sticking around. And how much did you drink? I just took a sip at first.
I just took a second sip. And...
Does it get better?
No.
So it actually, it has a cumulative negative effect.
I just, it was just a refresh. It's just like, here's some more of that.
Well, I mean, you know, I've had some bloating and such lately. I'm wondering if I have worms or stomach parasites, so maybe I should keep drinking.
Keep drinking it. I don't have other words to describe this.
See, I'm afraid that if I were to just then finish this, you know, I tell you that I poured like a shot.
Yeah, me too.
If I were to finish this, though, that the effect of that much at once would not sit well in my stomach. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I've drunk about half of the shot that I poured myself.
I'm not terribly interested in feeling ill. But I mean, I don't know that people feel ill. It just tastes bad, right? But I'm also not a brown alcohol drinker.
See, I don't, and I'm having a hard time identifying this as a brown alcohol.
This is a brown alcohol. As a liqueur, it's something different.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not really a brown alcohol. So it
shouldn't it's different.
Necessarily have that same. Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hacha.
And it comes in right away. Like, I just try to take a very small sip, and immediately, like... Here's the thing. A small sip doesn't give you less damage than a large sip.
Oh, it does.
You think so?
No, if you fill your mouth up with a shot, it does. It starts to go sinus, goes north, and it does then head south more. You feel it more in the chestal region. It's kind of on the lips now. I don't know. What it's doing there?
I worked hard to keep it off the lips. Oh boy. All right. I got a little bit left. I'm starting to sweat, and I don't know if that's because of the Malort or just from laughing at your description.
No, I think it is. Because it's also warm here for me right now. I wish it was cooler in my home most of the time. But you know what? I could easily see, though, that there are people that would like this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like bitter things.
It's got a real musty taste to it. That's the part that I think, to me, has it stand apart from other alcoholic drinks, like non-brewed drinks, non-beer, wine. You know, all those other things are kind of, you get those with a lot of different... You know,
yeah, this
beverages, but it's that mustiness that just it sits in there, and it's like, F you, man. It's just, I'm going nowhere.
This tastes like a basement in an old house that has persistent moisture in it.
Well, you know, and that's a very Chicago thing too, right? You got your bungalow.
Sure is.
And you got the rumpus room down in the basement. You've carpeted your basement. Mm. Bang up idea.
And, yeah. But you know, your window wells leak a little bit.
Right. So yeah. Then it gets behind your wood paneling.
Mm, yeah.
And
Tastes like mildew.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Like, okay. It's not like if you were to lick a stinky shoe. It's like if you took a bite of a stinky shoe. So, because you got, there's almost like a rubbery sense in there too.
Yeah, a little
bit. So if we're going to describe this like a wine, I get a little bit of musty basement and rubber. And
Yeah. Yeah, I would say musty basement and, insole of a shoe.
It really won't go away from the back of my mouth.
Well, I would normally hit the cough button, but I want you to understand that's part of the experience here.
I have in front of me. Oh, go ahead.
I brought a Coke Zero to try to flush this out. It's
not working, is it?
I haven't started yet.
So I have in front of me a Dr. Brown's Black Cherry soda.
Nice.
Dr. Brown's the famous New York deli sort of soda, Jewish deli sort of soda. And
I thought this was Doc Brown from Back to the Future.
No, it's not.
So okay, that's weird.
What? Oh, mixing
I just
them together?
Took a drink of the Coke Zero, and then I got it in the chest more.
Carried it with it down?
Like, fought back. So like, you're not getting rid of me that easily. Which again speaks of, like Chicago. Yes. West Side Rumpus Room.
Punch me, knock me down. I'm still here.
That's right.
I can do this again.
Al, get out of here. No. You can't make me.
Oh. Those Przelewski brothers, you can't stop them. Oh my God.
You can't.
I mean, I'm tempted to put a little bit of the Dr. Brown's mixed with the mold and see.
Oh, no.
Did you ever do like a shot size in your mouth?
Not a full shot. I took the last
half.
What
we had left? Okay, good.
All at once.
And, I mean, did it kind of, it did
oh,
amplify.
Lord. Are you looking at your shot glass? You talked about oiliness.
Oh, yeah. It's all like clinging to the side.
It's got like legs. Yeah. That's troubling. So that's Jepson's Malort. It's only 70 proof, but and I still have a lot of my 750 milliliters left.
So I put a sip size or like a gulp size of Dr. Brown's in my shot glass.
Yeah.
Swished it around.
Yeah.
Drank it. And this Dr. Brown's Black Cherry is a pretty strong Black Cherry flavor.
Mm-hmm.
It did not taste like Black Cherry anymore. There was no more Malort actually in the glass, just what was left clinging to the glass. Swirled that around.
All right, I'm going to try that with my, because this is actually Coke Zero Cherry, which is not the same as Doc Brown's.
No, Dr. Brown's.
Dr. Brown's, sorry.
That's respect.
No, I won't. All right, I'm going to try my Cherry Coke Zero.
Oh, boy.
Out of my Malort glass. Now, I will say that the Cherry Coke Zero has overpowered the Malort.
Oh, man. Well,
keep in mind, Coca-Cola will
right
take the rust off of something.
So here's what's going to happen with this bottle of Malort here. It's going to go next to the bottle of Everclear that I've got.
Yeah.
Things that you wouldn't just drink, right? I don't even know how I ended up with a bottle of Everclear.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I have one. And what's going to happen is when my kids get to be about 17, 18.
Yeah.
And maybe if it seems like they're going to be the sort that will want to go to a high school party and drink.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, you know, that's fine. I want to just see first how you react to alcohol before you go out. Because I want to make sure if you're going to do it, yeah. I don't know if mm-hmm. I can stop you. I want to do it safely.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, I think I could stop them from drinking.
Huh?
Not entirely, but if nothing else, we can, you know, engage religion to guilt sure. them.
Yeah.
That's what worked for our parents.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But I'll say here, just want you to try some regular alcohol. And see, is this something you want to do? And
this is absolutely regular. I am just an ordinary alcoholic beverage.
Hello, fellow alcoholic beverages. What's going on today?
Oh.
Hello, Peach Absolute Vodka. Hello.
Hello, Jim. Other teens.
Hello, Screwdriver. I am also a regular drink teen. My name is Al Ort. Hi.
Al Ort. Yeah.
You know, if you take away the RT, it's Malo.
I was about to say, you can't spell Mal without Malort.
So then I'll give my kids a tumbler full of Malort and say, let's enjoy some together. Yeah. And I will even drink it with them just to...
Well, Josh is 20. I'm thinking about sitting down and having some Malort with him just to...
But I don't think that's fair if he's not showing any interest in drinking.
Push him right? a couple years farther away from any alcohol.
Do you think he's interested in drinking?
Oh, I know he's not.
Right.
So no, this would just be mean. Okay.
You don't have to hurt him then. You know, see, that's right. It's interesting. Kids nowadays, some of those things have changed, like their willingness to do things.
Yeah.
Like there's so many more young people now that are like, well, I don't want to learn how to drive. It's scary and dangerous.
It is.
Yeah, it is. Actually, yeah. I mean, you were hurtling down the road in 2,000 pounds of plastic and steel, propelled by a hundreds of horsepower combustion engine.
That's right.
It is scary, but...
Things like Malort remind you that the world is a dangerous place with bad consequences sometimes.
But there are things, you know, I feel like there's some... You know, you have to push boundaries, right? Yeah. You have to learn how to do some of these things.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I don't know if Malort serves a purpose there other than the purpose I described with young people, but, you know.
So before we go to break, I want to share this. Malort's a very small company, but they at one point invited fans to create, slogans.
You've looked this up? Are you referencing this?
I am referencing this.
Sorry if I was showing out the sausage just made. I know this is probably off. This is off the top of your head.
No, I did some crack research myself. I called up
crack research. Huh?
I called up the Malort people. I called up old Jep and his son, and
It is now owned by a company called CH Distillery. In Pilsen.
What are they doing with their lives?
It was made out of Illinois for a long time, outside of the state of Illinois.
Yeah.
Florida.
It was made in Florida?
Yes, it was.
That tracks.
It's kind of the Florida man of drinks, isn't it?
I was going to say, this tastes like a Chicago rec room, but it certainly has the emotional vibe of Florida man. You're right.
Okay. It tastes like a Florida basement, which there are no basements in Florida basement is a swimming pool. Go ahead.
Indeed. So here are some of the slogans that people came up with.
Yeah.
I think I've already referenced Malort, kick your mouth in the balls.
Yep.
Malort, when you need to unfriend someone in person. Malort, tonight's the night you fight your dad. Malort, the champagne of pain. Malort, turning taste buds into taste foes for generations. Drink Malort, it's easier than telling people you have nothing to live for. Malort, what soap washes its mouth out with. And, I'll bleep this, but Malort, these pants aren't... Sorry, I'll try that again. Malort, these pants aren't going to shit themselves.
You know what? All right, so we're going to take a break.
Yeah.
And then we'll
come back and do an overdue record review then.
All right, very good.
All right, be right back.
Not back yet?
No, because most of that was disgusting and vile, and I don't think
it's better going down than coming up. It's a good pullout.
Exactly right.
Maybe if you're...
I cannot stop coughing now that we've had Malort. Okay, we are back.
Maybe if your skills can pull that out and like put that in at the very end. Just as like a tag at the very end.
That could be. Okay, so we're back. The last thing we want to do today is... we started doing overdue record reviews, and last time... Kevin reviewed the album Clairvoyance by Screaming Trees.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I thought what would be a great idea would be for me to listen to it and then just give my really quick response. And my very quick response is, I liked it. It's good stuff. And I could definitely hear what you were saying, that at the beginning of their career, they're much more psychedelic. But then one of the things that I realized out of that was that hearing that, and then I listened to a couple of their albums. I didn't listen to every album all the way up to their big hit album, which is the one that you and I both were very familiar with. And once again, I've forgotten the name of. I'm trying to look it up really quickly. That's good podcasting right there.
It's Sweet of... No, that's my song on there.
Yeah. Yeah, it is called Sweet Oblivion.
Excellent.
Way to go. I thought it was called Sweet Oblivion, and I didn't want to trust myself. So I didn't listen to every album all the way up to that, but you can hear the psychedelic elements sort of getting smaller in the overall mix as time goes on, but they're still there. So then I realized, listening to, like, jumping ahead to Sweet Oblivion, I can hear where it is more psychedelic than the other Seattle stuff that was coming out at that time.
Right, and I think also kind of then putting that full perspective together, you realize it's not like the first album was like hardcore psychedelic.
Right.
It just incorporates kind of a little bit more of that kind of some elements of that. And it's you see that there's a consistency with the band, that they still kind of work at subtly incorporating some kind of divergent musical styles, paths.
Yeah.
And I think that's based upon those, that being the case between the members of the band.
Yeah.
And eventually they, you know, kind of call it quits. But I think ultimately you get a sense that it was a pretty talented band in terms of what they were trying to do. They did something very different than what anyone else was doing at the time, even if it didn't immediately strike you as dramatically different.
Yeah.
So but you have something new for us today.
I do. Actually, but the last thing I want to do is I want to say really quickly that if that psychedelic music is up your alley, you could still check out the guitarist of Screaming Trees, whose name is Gary Lee Connor. Among his most recent albums, I haven't listened to these. I just love these titles. Are The Microdot Gnome, Ether Trippers, Unicorn Curry, Revelations in Fuzz, and The Opposite of Christmas. So I don't think he's given up on hallucinogenics.
No, it doesn't sound like it.
you could check that out. It's good stuff. I mean, I love him as a guitarist, so I just might check that out. Anyway, so what I wanted to bring, so again, thank you for introducing me to Clairvoyance, introducing us to Clairvoyance by Screaming Trees. The thing I wanted to bring today, so you got me thinking about it, and I was, because even listening to some of that stuff from that time period, I was wondering, so what did I miss from that time period? As you said, some of it maybe is because music was not as easy to get at that time as it is now. Not everything was just on a universal platform. But also, I was going to Bible college. And while me and my friends made an effort to not be completely, you know, insulated in Bible college, I do think it had an insulating quality. And so I decided to grab a random year and look at what were some of the really top albums from that year and what was maybe something that I missed that seemed like it would have been in my lane anyway. And I realized that I have never listened to anything by the band My Bloody Valentine, which is one of those bands that people talk about as essential for like alternative rock and like really the progenitors of Shoegazer and a lot of that kind of stuff. So they, without going too deep into this, they put out a first album, then they put out their second album, which is really considered their best work, and it's called Loveless. Came out in 91, and so I listened to it for the first time over the last week, a couple of times, and I'm here to tell you that it's, on my first listen, I was really, really underwhelmed, and I realized that it was actually because I needed a little time. I listened to it, listened to some other stuff from that time period, and I came back to it. I needed to reorient myself to how differently music was being mixed at that time. And once I did that, because some of this is to that whole era, but some of this was really distinctive to that band. They mixed their vocals really deep, like buried them in the mix. And the vocals are often really kind of high and ethereal, kind of dreamy. And actually, one of the most pronounced instruments that you hear on several of this, not the whole album, but on a bunch of it, especially the more experimental stuff, is the cymbals. Like, I realized that in some of these songs, there's just like a constant, the tinging of the cymbal is riding through the entire song. Almost like a, to me, it like kind of weighed it down almost. So some of that stuff, the album's interesting because it starts with a couple of songs that are really pretty experimental in that regard. And this is very, again, the vocals are buried deep. They're very dreamy. And the guitar parts are more like long sheets of feedback and bending notes and stuff like that. You and I were talking a little bit about this, that Smashing Pumpkins is a band that we both like a lot, really identified them as a major influence. And I can hear it, but the difference is that Billy Corgan from Smashing Pumpkins loves guitar riffs, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are very few guitar riffs in this because the guitar is mostly atmospheric. And then in the second half of the album, there are a couple of songs that are a little more, they sound like they were aiming for getting some radio airplay. And you at least get, it gets less atmospheric and a little bit more structured, but you still don't really ever get to that riffiness. And so I like it. I liked it more the second listen and the third listen than I did the first listen, for sure. Because it just took me a while to, it was almost like relearning a language. You know what I mean? Like if you try listening to, like if you haven't watched any Shakespeare in a while, it takes a while to get used to English spoken that way. It took me a little while to reorient my ear to sort of the musical and like sound production language of the early 90s.
All right.
And once I got there, it's good stuff. It's good stuff. Again, some of the distinctives that they tend to do is like very sweepy kind of stuff. It's very textured, like heavily affected guitars. Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff that's like almost like razor blade or barbed wire type guitar. You know what I mean?
I think so.
And so there's a lot of that.
I have not heard the album before either.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be listening to it. So I'm taking in what you're saying.
Sure, sure.
So that I can second guess you.
Oh, I like that. I'm looking forward to that. I love to be second guessed.
Mm-hmm. That was weird. Mm-hmm.
That's why we get married. But my wife doesn't listen to the podcast. So. Anyway.
A little bit sexist.
A little bit sexist. I wasn't saying that generally about why one gets married.
Oh,
I'm saying about why I got married.
So you could be second guest.
I'll probably just cut all of that out.
It's up to you. I mean, I was trying to give you some room to kind of...
To hang myself.
Well, I mean, probably maybe you would demonstrate something other than a hanging.
No,
but
no.
I don't
didn't
know
happen.
How you got there.
So anyway, so I honestly really liked it. It each time I listened to it, I liked it more, and I can definitely hear. What's really funny is I can like Billy Corgan says that they were a huge influence, but then like I said, they don't seem to have like the hard rock, like the 70s rock riff heavy influence that he had. So to me, I only hear the, like in Smashing Pumpkins' first album, I only hear like little bits of that influence. Smashing Pumpkins' second album, Siamese Dream, which is what most people think is their first album, I think. Actually, I can hear it more because Billy does more of that vocal style. So you're going to hear vocals, and in the second album, they bring the vocals a little bit more forward. You're going to hear that their vocals remind you of his vocals a lot, or the other way around. But the guitar elements of it are really, really different, I think. So anyway, I liked it. But I can also see why it didn't break out big, because even the songs that sound like they were intended to be like singles aren't that easy to just drop in by themselves.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, I think there's a long history of music that is less accessible,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of like popularly accessible, that ends up in, or having, you know, kind of an impact on the direction that more popular music goes.
Yes.
So, you know, that's
what I actually thought was really interesting was, again, I listened to this album, Loveless, and I went back and listened to their first album. Their first album, the first half of it sounds like, or maybe the first third of it, sounds like them trying this kind of more experimental sort of noise soundscape kind of thing. And then it shifts to being much more traditional, like rock structure.
Interesting.
And so the first four songs, like Billy Corgan says that album was his biggest influence, or one of his biggest influences on his first couple, the first couple of Smashing Pumpkins albums. I can hear that in like the first four songs. After that, now this is going to be a reference that most people will not get, you will get. After that, the rest of that first My Bloody Valentine album made me think of the Stull EP from Urge Overkill.
Mm, okay.
Very much that kind of vibe. Which cracked me up. because I was like, that's two really different Chicago bands that this one album kind of sounds like both of them.
Interesting. I wouldn't say I'm a huge fan of the Stall.
Well, it's not their best, but I like parts of it.
Well, sure. I mean, there's... Yeah, I mean, there's... Sure. It's not...
But yes. Simple. Yeah, it's... It's a little odd. Anyway.
I don't feel like I need to spare their feelings.
No, you don't.
I'm comfortable just saying, eh, it wasn't really fully my cup of tea.
But listen, if Nash Kato wants to come on the podcast and talk about it, I'm willing. Are you okay with that?
That's fine. Any of them, if, you know... Black Onassis, who I think they had a falling out with.
Yeah.
Or the other dude, Eddie.
I never knew how to pronounce Eddie's last name.
Grosser?
I don't know. That sounds good. Like rhymes with Grosser?
Yeah. Or Rosser? I don't know. Either way.
Yeah.
Nice. There's a bakery on Milwaukee Avenue with that same name. I've never heard how that was pronounced either.
Maybe while I'm in town, I'll go in and ask them how they pronounce it.
All right.
All right.
You've got a lot on your plate when you get in here. So. A
lot on my plate, because, yeah. Well, we haven't even told people the other big thing that we plan on doing, which is, well, let's keep that a secret for now. So let's say goodbye, and we'll talk to you soon.
That sounds good. I look forward to that happening. Fellow teenager.
Yes. I am an actual horse.
Oh my. And
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Love you.